His name was Schofield. He was a lawyer, no religious training, and he'd been in jail for forgery, and then he decided that he was going to write the Bible. It's not the predominant form of Christianity anywhere in the world. It's pretty startling that people consider themselves Christian and then think that what's going on in Gaza is something that their faith compels them to support. I find that absolutely, absolutely stunning.
This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Safe. I don't know if you can hear it, but I can hear one of my boys getting time out downstairs. They're
very vaguely.
How are you doing, sir? It's been a while. It's been, I think, over a year. I think the last time we spoke was when you were in Austin.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I'm doing great, man. It's good to be catching up to you, with you, yeah. And to you, always.
There's a lot going on in the world. I reached
Indeed.
Out. I mean, you've been very vocal about what's going on in Gaza. And actually, right before we hopped on the stream here, there was a headline coming out of the International Court of Justice at The Hague has ruled that Israel's settlement policy in the occupied Palestinian territories violates international law. And I think that's what's been really interesting about your approach to this conflict. What's going on is really revolving around property rights and the infringement on those property rights of Palestinian citizens. And it seems like the Court of International Justice is agreeing that these settlement takeovers are a violation of international law.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty absurd to try and think up of some kind of consistent legal, moral justification for trying to justify this, which is just blatant theft. There's no sugarcoating it. It's just blatant, out in the open theft. And most people are just completely unfamiliar with what's going on in Palestine and Israel. They just go by the headlines that are put in front of them. And that, of course, always focuses on what Palestinians do and the reactions that Palestinians have to this stuff, but rarely ever emphasizes the conditions under which Israeli occupation places Palestinians. And when people find out, the initial response I usually get from people is just, no, this, there's no way this is true. There's no way what you're saying is true. Obviously, it's not like that. Obviously, Israel can't possibly be this bad. And they are sort of in denial about it because they can't really believe that something like this could be going on in the world today, this blatantly, and nothing is being done about it. And when you tell them, well, yeah, that's why some Palestinians do nasty things to respond to that, it makes them quite uncomfortable because they're people much prefer to stay in the cocoon of self-righteousness wherein we are good and all of our friends and allies are good and everybody else is just bad. And we do good things because we're good and they do bad things because they're bad. So obviously everything they do is bad. Everything we do is good. And this is just administrative stuff. You know, it's imperfect. It's just the government doing government things. There are inefficient governments everywhere. But clearly Israel cannot be doing bad things, but no, it is. I think I always like to start with this fact whenever I'm trying to discuss this conflict, that ultimately what it really comes down to is land property rights theft. Now, of course, here you might say, well, land is a shitcoin, land is an outdated thing, who cares? I'm sympathetic to all these arguments that people shouldn't be fighting about land. But in order to not be fighting about land, we need to have property rights in land. And so The problem is not that we people attach too much importance to land. The problem is if you don't have property rights in land, then you're going to have extremely problematic outcomes emerge. And so what it really comes down to is that in 1945, the British government, which was still ruling the land at that point, they organized a very thorough census and survey of all lands in Palestine. And they came up with the estimate of the ownership that belonged to various communities. And so this was at a time when Britain was fully committed to Zionism and they wanted to make sure that Israel would be established. And they were trying to get some kind of arrangement going wherein the local population could accept more and more migrants coming from Europe to Palestine in order to establish the country. And so they did a survey of the land, and 5.6% of the land was owned by Jews. And now some of those Jews obviously are Palestinian natives. They'd been there for decades and centuries, or centuries, maybe millennia in some cases, but they were a very small minority. But then most of the rest was migrants. So at that point, migrants who were Jewish could come and buy land, but they only managed to buy about 5.6% of all of the land. So that obviously is going to be a sticking point if you're trying to set up a country that is based on an ethno-religious basis, wherein it's considered a national homeland for one group, and that group only happens to own 5% of the land in the country. Obviously a very, very tricky thing. Now, today, flash forward 80 years later, and here we are, and we have roughly 90% probably of the land of Palestine is owned by the Israeli government. Not just Israelis, but owned by the Israeli government. So how could you go from 5% that is owned by all Jews privately, as well as the Jewish National Fund and a bunch of other organizations that became part of the state, how do you go from 5% to 90%, roughly? Theft. That's what's been going on. And the settlements are just the latest chapter. It's just the thing, it's this what happened in 1947, it's what happened in 1948, it happened in 1967. It happened throughout 48 to 67 in the areas that are under Israeli control, that were under Israeli control at that point, so not the West Bank and Gaza. And then since 1967, when Israel took over the West Bank and Gaza, it's been happening in the West Bank, Gaza, to a lesser extent. There were some settlements there, but Gaza was always way too crowded for there to be too much opportunity to take land. But in the West Bank, at this point, more than half of the West Bank is effectively owned by the State of Israel.
Yeah, and it's, as you mentioned, it's been happening over the course of, at this point, 80 years, and it seems like it's been a slow grind towards this. And obviously now we have a massive conflict going on over there. And as an American, looking at what's going on, how our government's responding, it's just really conflicting, because it's obviously nobody ever likes to see kinetic warfare being waged in both directions. And you see all these videos of innocent civilians getting murdered. And that's just what I wonder is, like, what is the resolution to this conflict? Obviously, it's been going on for a while. It seems like it's vitriolic on both sides. And that's somebody, again, outside looking in, like, how do you come to a resolution of this in a way that ends the war as quickly as possible?
I mean, the very sad answer to your question is that I think the answer we're heading toward is mass murder and expulsion of Palestinians until there is no longer conflict. This is essentially what Israelis are very openly saying. And this is what the Minister of Finance, who's extremely important and influential in the Israeli government today, says. Palestinians need to accept that they have three options. They can die, or they can leave, or they can accept living under Israeli sovereignty and control. And that's it. Those are your three other options. So October 7 gave them a great excuse, because these people were already in government and they already had these kind of ideas. They follow the ideas of a man called Meir Kahana, who was declared a terrorist in the US and in Israel. truly, by any definition of the term, he was a terrorist. And in his mind, it's a very simple conflict. God gave us this land, and anybody who is not part of us should leave or die. And, you know, Smotrich, the finance minister, follows that line, although he does add a tiny little bit of moderation to it in that he says, okay, maybe some of them can stay if they accept that they are always going to be living under Israeli Jewish national rule, and that they're not going to be equal citizens to Israelis. That's essentially the way that it is going. And I think this is... it's an amazing thing because nowhere else in the world do you have this kind of brazen criminality anymore. In fact, I mean, the world is continuously heading toward a more civilized way of dealing with one another. In that wars or, you know, we try and make wars more contained, and you try and... accept the idea that people have natural rights. People have rights to own property that are not not open to just being completely destroyed because they have the wrong religion. You see everywhere in the world, people are constantly becoming more and more accepting of other identities, and through immigration and through interaction with business or culture or sport or music, the whole world is becoming more and more open to each other and to accepting each other. And there's one exception in one place in the world where it's just considered that it has to be the case that one group has to have property rights because of their ethno-religious identity, whereas another group just doesn't. I don't know other examples where it is this stark. You can't just buy land if you're Palestinian in Palestine. You just cannot do it. The Israeli government won't sell you any of the land that it owns. It'll take your land and assign it to foreigners who have no connection to the land, who just come and claim to be Jewish. They get to live in that land and they get to stay in it. And you can't buy it back for any price. I don't know of other places where this happens, where people just lose their land because of their religion or race or ethnicity. And this is why, honestly, I mean, before everybody got sick of wokeism and identity politics, when I first came to the US 20 years ago, I just could never take any of that bullshit seriously in the US, because in my mind, I just looked at everybody and I just said, you know, nobody ever took your house because of your identity. And so everything else that you're complaining about is really inconsequential nonsense that you probably just need to get over. I mean, it's really incomparable to anything else. You've never been kicked off of a road or shot at for going on a road or arrested for going on a road where you're not supposed to go just because of your identity. And so that really puts into perspective all of the identity politics that you see in the West.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. And you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and their rolling out a bunch of other products, including Inheritance Protocol and Sound Advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com.
I think really diving into, again, going like first principles, property rights, and separating that from like religious, divine proclamation that you own something? Like, how do you separate those two? Because obviously there are countries in the Middle East that are theocratic monarchies to some extent, and so how do we sort of work through like property rights as an individual, taking religion out of it, and then what some deem to be a religious proclamation, a right to land?
Yeah, I mean, I think the theology there is pretty suspect. I think there are a lot of very convincing arguments that modern Zionism, modern political Zionism, is neither consistent with the Jewish nor the Christian faith. And I think the fact that when the Zionist movement was first established, it was established by a bunch of secular atheists, Eastern European socialists mainly. They were the ones who wanted this as a nationalist project and as an internalization of anti-Semitism. I think this is something that's highly underrated, which is that people like Theodor Herzl, I mean, he was very anti-Semitic in his own words. He just did not like being Jewish, and he internalized a lot of the prejudice that Europeans had towards Jews in terms of the fact that they thought Jews could never assimilate into the West. And therefore, he thought that the only solution was for them to leave Europe and go to somewhere else. And so it wasn't religious. He then chose Palestine among several choices, Uganda, Nebraska, Argentina were some of the candidates. But he chose Palestine because of the sentimental reason. So it's important to here to note that it isn't like this is some religious movement within the Jewish faith that finally materialized in the early 19th century. This was 19th century ethno-nationalism, socialism, statism, fascism, growing up everywhere in Eastern Europe around that time. And these guys just thought of applying it for a people on another piece of land. And when Herzl wanted to hold his first Zionist Congress, he wanted to hold it in Munich, and he was not allowed to hold it in Munich by the Munich Jewish community. There was enormous amount of European rejection of Zionism when it first came out as an idea, for a very good reason, which is that if you start campaigning for Jews in Germany to leave Germany, then you're telling the non-Jews in Germany that Jews don't belong in Germany. And that was a big problem for them, because a lot of these people, I'd say the vast majority of Jews around that period, they did not think of themselves as exiled Palestinians in Europe. They thought of themselves as Germans or Frenchmen or Poles or Russians. They were part of these countries, and they had been for centuries. And also, I think a very important point, they could all move to Palestine. There was nothing stopping them from Palestine, so from moving to Palestine. And yet they didn't, because it wasn't like they were in exile. The Jews were not allowed to return to Palestine up until the year 637, when it was under Roman control. The Romans were the ones who expelled the Jews and prevented them from coming back. But then since the Muslims took over in 637, it was possible for Jews to go back to Palestine and to live and buy property there. And they did start going in the 19th century, but they hadn't gone before because they don't think of themselves as exiled Palestinians. They are German or Polish or whatever identity they happen to be from. And Judaism was a religion for them, not a national movement. And so this idea that it is some kind of divine mandate, I find to be very unconvincing. But even if it were, that of course doesn't justify violating other people's property rights. This is classic religious fundamentalism. That's nonsensical. In other words, we've spent the last 20 years getting lectured about religious fundamentalism and about how bad religious fundamentalism is. And of course, the poster child for that is Islamic terrorism. And I think the essence of the critique is very important, in that your religion cannot justify the violation of the property rights of others. You can't just say that, well, because God said this, then that person can die. And then we just expect that to be an acceptable part of normal civilized society, because anybody can say there God says all kinds of strange things. And this is when religious fundamentalism really becomes a massive problem. And this is essentially what Zionism is. It's saying that the rights of Palestinians, the property of Palestinians, the lives of Palestinians are not something that can be respected. And therefore, it is okay to violate their property, violate their rights, without them having to commit any error. So you're born Palestinian, and it's okay to kill you when you're one day old because you're Palestinian, because you're not born Jewish. And this land was assigned for by God for Jewish people only. This is really the level of religious fundamentalism that is in power in Israel at this point. And of course, when you listen to Israel propagandists in the West, they emphasize the liberal, more cosmopolitan face of Israel. They talk about the Tel Aviv tech scene, and they talk about the progressive aspects of Israel, the gay pride parades, and so on. They don't really talk about what is the ideology that is now becoming an increasingly important part of the country, and in fact, the motivating ideology for likely a majority of the population, which is this messianic Zionism, which completely rejects the idea that other human beings have any rights. And so, just to give you a glimpse about this, of course, you don't see this on your TV and you don't hear about it from your favorite based influencers on the internet, but the current minister of national security in the government, also one of the most important people in Israeli politics at this point, his name is Itamar Ben-Gvir. There's video of him dancing in a wedding. And in that wedding, the wedding was organized by a bunch of settlers in the West Bank, so people who live on stolen Palestinian land. Mm-hmm. And they were dancing with a picture of a baby that was burned to death by these settlers or their friends. An 18-month baby was living in a family house with his mom and dad, and they burned the house down on the family while the family was in there. And they have songs about the baby, celebrating the burning of the baby. And it's become such a part of the folklore that they dance to it in their weddings. And this guy was at the wedding while they were dancing this, and this video of him that you can see on Twitter. And this isn't just some fluke. You see this over and over and over again, with just really the natural conclusion of this, of the indulgence of this kind of fanaticism, of the indulgence of this kind of religious fanaticism, wherein you dehumanize somebody else, you completely refuse to accept that other people have rights, and you base that on some religious ideas that you have, and then you act like an animal towards other human beings that have not aggressed against you. And then, of course, you wonder why these people fight back. And this is ultimately what I view as the root cause of the conflict. Because before this kind of messianic religious fundamentalist ideology came to Palestine, from 637 up until 1947, up until 1948, or let's say 1917 when the British took over. So from 637 to 1917, when Palestine was under various different Islamic rulers, it was possible for Muslims, Christians, and Jews to live and own land in Palestine. And Jews lived there as part of the people of Palestine, and they had friendly relations with Muslims and Christians. And so this the problem of anti-Semitism that was huge in Europe at that time was not as big a problem anywhere, as big as a problem. And I've come across this text of a rabbi from Poland traveling to Palestine in 1747 and going to Hebron, where there was a small Jewish community, and talking about just how friendly the relations were between the Jewish community and the Muslim and Christian communities. And he was saying with surprise that on Shabbat, they just leave their courtyard open and nobody goes there. Nobody bothers them. Muslims come and celebrate with them on their religious occasions, and everything's very friendly. It was like that. And so the idea that Palestinians are just congenitally predisposed to anti-Semitism is ridiculous nonsense. It's only believable by people who have absolutely no idea about what's actually going on the ground, which is that since the birth of the Zionist movement, the property rights of Palestinians have been considered null and void. And any Palestinian who doesn't like it and tries to find back is legitimate target for murder. And the result is tens, probably hundreds of Palestinians, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians by now have been killed. And I mean, the vast majority of Palestinian property has been stolen. Hundreds of thousands of houses have been demolished. Even before this current onslaught on Gaza, which is like nothing we'd seen before, something like 140,000 houses, Palestinian houses, were demolished by Israel over the past 80 years. Something like 90% of Palestinians' land was stolen. Tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have been imprisoned by Israel. Pretty much everybody, or not everybody, but I mean a big chunk of the population ends up going to prison and subjected to enormously brutal forms of torture. It's just incredible the kind of sadism that they're subjected to, because you're talking about a population that is not viewed as human. So the Israeli prisoners, prison masters, just don't think of prisoners as human beings, and they do incredibly horrific, sadist things to them. And this has just been the case over and over and over and over again. And it continues. And that's what it's, that's religious fundamentalism.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com. Safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on our risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off.
It's really odd because I recorded with Whitney, I think like a year ago, Whitney Webb, and she made me aware of like the Christian Zionist movement, which is trying to bring about the end days, which sort of supports everything going on there. And you dig into that particular sect of Christianity, and similarly to what you just described, like has no connection to what was actually written in the Bible or the Gospels. It was sort of made up on the go to bring about end times. And so you have this weird contingent of Christians around the world that are Christian fundamentalists that are pushing for this too. It's just all very confusing and sad, and it gets to the point of like just really understanding history and how we got here is important, because if you don't understand that, you can just take what is being put out there as the truth, and it seems like there's a lot of research that needs to be done and understanding of history to actually have a well-rounded view of how we got here and what's actually going on today.
Yeah, I think I've been looking more and more into this whole Christian Zionism thing, and it's absolutely fascinating how that's been utilized. I think it's actually hilarious because the reference Bible that all of these dispensationalist Christians base their insanities upon is something written in the 20th century by a con artist who had spent time in jail for forgery, that he was a lawyer. He had no religious training. His name was Schofield, and he'd been in jail for forgery. And then he decided that he was going to write the Bible that is going to shape the views of tens of millions of Christians for the next century or so. And it's really remarkable, because you start looking into the interpretation of the verses that are shown as indicating that you need to be supporting this current secular mass murdering bunch of terrorists in a government. And first of all, it's all in the footnotes. So all of his analysis is in the footnotes, and all of these stuff is in the footnotes that he's added. And I was looking into the particular verses, and it's pretty remarkable how they've been interpreted in a way that clearly makes no sense. So God tells Abraham, "I will bless you." And then that's supposedly interpreted as being a blessing of the people of Israel, which who hadn't even existed at that point, because Abraham had preceded that. It was much earlier. So the entire thing, I think, is extremely suspect on a theological basis. And it's not the predominant form of Christianity anywhere in the world. And it's being used in a very, very political way, because this is, again, the insanity. Once your religion goes into a point where you think it's okay to kill innocent people, you probably need to sit down and have a very hard talk with yourself about what kind of person you are and what kind of God you're worshiping. If if religion was a mechanism for getting people to kill each other and getting people to kill innocent people, then it wouldn't quite work. That's not the point. The point is of religion is very different than this kind of brutality. And it's pretty startling that people consider themselves Christian and then think that what's going on in Gaza is something that their faith compels them to support. I find that absolutely, absolutely stunning.
Yeah, and I mean, as you mentioned earlier, I mean, throughout my life at least, we've been taught that, like, Islam is the religion of war and basically conflict, and it's what's the word I'm looking for, like a militaristic theology, if you will. And what are some of the mischaracterizations of that? Obviously, there have been fundamentalist Islamic groups that have popped up and exist and still exist today, but how are people in the West maybe misinterpreting what the Quran is saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, obviously a lot of bad things has been done in the name of all kinds of religions. And again, religious fanaticism and fundamentalism. Once you have that righteousness of knowing that this is what God wants, then you are, in the case of many people, I think that you're able to just get over your humanity and get over the things that make human civilization possible. And I think this is extremely, extremely dangerous in whatever religion. But I'd say, though, you know, in Islam, the rules of war in Islam are pretty clearly laid out, that you should not kill innocents. You should not even kill the cows of your enemies. You should not even kill the tree. You shouldn't even cut off a tree in war. That's the explicit text. Now, obviously, some people misinterpret it or interpret it differently and justify that, you know, in case you have no other way of fighting, then targeting civilians would be legitimate. So a lot of the Islamist terrorists would try and go with that interpretation. But I think ultimately it's very similar to the situation you see with any religion, in that people can get that self-righteousness that then supersedes the basic moral code of humanity and of religion, which is don't kill, don't steal, don't violate the rights of others. And the self-righteousness can make them go and ignore the basics, fundamentalists of the religion, of morality, of what makes civilized life possible. And this is really what it comes down to. I mean, when you think about what's going on ultimately, what I'd like to tell people is this. Can you think of anywhere in the world where you could apply Israeli occupation to a piece of land and expect that there would be no conflict. I mean, the percentage of Jews in the U.S. today is similar to the percentage of Jews in Palestine when the Balfour Declaration came out. Something like, I think it's around 2 or 3%, something like that, 4% maybe. Not sure the exact numbers, but it's that kind of range. So imagine if you said you wanted to make the U.S. or any particular state in the U.S. a homeland for Jews, and then 95% of the population in that country or state or region is not Jewish. What is going to go on? What is going to happen? If you try and implement the same laws that Israel has about who gets to own land, who gets to keep land, who gets to have their houses demolished, and who gets to get free houses, and then try to apply them anywhere else, you're going to have conflict. And that's just the reality of it.
It seems like things are pretty dire right now. As you mentioned earlier, like the resolution that's been laid forth by the Israeli government isn't really encouraging. And I know that you had Thomas Massie on, who obviously has been speaking out against AIPAC's influence here in the U.S. And like, do you think this is up to the West to really step in and sort of be the mediator and say, hey, this can't go on?
I mean, I think that's probably the only thing that's going to stop it, other than some kind of full-on regional war, which would be absolutely devastating. Because realistically, and Israeli generals have said this from practically the second week of this war, which is, if the U.S. stops giving Israel weapons, the war is over. They can't keep firing. I mean, the amount of artillery that they've dropped and the amount of explosives that they've dropped over Gaza, and Gaza is a tiny, tiny area. It's about 400 square kilometers. So it's really tiny. And if you look at the amount of ammunition that's been dropped on it, I mean, it's practically left no spot unbombed at least once. Everything's been destroyed. Everything's been devastated. The amount of money that it costs to create so much destruction and throw all of this stuff is completely unfathomable for a small society of 10 million people like Israel to be able to pull off on their own. It's just the industrial capacity to make this many weapons and drop them all the time for 9 going on 10 months almost now is just unthinkable for any practical purpose. And the only reason it goes on is because of the U.S. And the only reason the U.S. Keeps supporting this is because of stupid domestic U.S. politics. As you see, both political parties in the U.S. are just very obviously puppet regimes of Israeli intelligence services. It's not even debatable at this point. The only people who don't see anything wrong with it are people who just are so conditioned, you know, basically the NPCs who are so conditioned to take things as they are and go along with authority and not question anything. And so they just think it's completely normal for a country to have all of its political class constantly kissing the ass of a foreign country. It's not that common historically, but when it does happen, there's a very clear name for it. It's a puppet state. It's a state that's run by politicians of another country. And this is exactly the situation in the U.S. today, I think. It's very obvious both political parties are completely on board with whatever it is that the Israeli government does. The Israeli government faces more criticism and objections in Israel from its own people and its own parliament than it does from the American Congress. No American congressman, with the exception of Massie. Well, I mean, there are a few, but very few, a lot fewer American congressmen will be critical of the Israeli government than Israeli parliamentarians. And it's absurd because the U.S. pays tens of billions of dollars to Israel in all kinds of ways and forms. And I think the relationship is just so clearly dysfunctional for anybody who spends 5 minutes looking past the ridiculous, idiotic propaganda headlines. Israel has attacked the USS Liberty in 1967, murdered 37 American sailors and injured a couple of hundred. And they did it deliberately. They did it for a very long time. They did it while they very clearly saw there were American flags and the staff, the sailors on this on the Liberty, did everything they could to communicate, and they did communicate that there was an American staff. And there are recordings that have been released from the Israeli pilots telling the Israeli command center, look, this is an American ship. And the command center saying, yes, never mind, hit it. And they kept hitting it with artillery and with boats. And the plan was to sink it and leave no survivors. And they came very close to sinking it, but the USS Liberty crew managed to get a distress signal out, and another American boat started sailing towards the USS Liberty. And that then caused the Israelis to stop before they could finish the job. Now, why did they do that? They did it because they wanted the Americans to think that it was the Egyptians who did it. And then they were going to get the Americans to go to war with Egypt, possibly nuclear war with Egypt, because that was during the 1967 war. Now, that's just been completely covered up. Nobody talks about it in American politics. Nobody mentions it. Nobody wants to investigate it. Nobody wants to talk about it. There was a very sham investigation that was done over 5-6 days, and then it was covered up, and they said, oh, well, it was an accident, and they didn't know. It was a theater of war, fog of war. Nonsense. It was a clear summer day in the Mediterranean with giant American flags flying on a giant ship, and continuous signals from the sailors saying, we are American. And the Israeli command knew exactly what they're doing. And yet nobody in American politics dares talk about this. And that's why I think, you know, American political class are traitors. There's no other way of putting it. If you are willing to watch your soldiers die and not say or do anything about it, let alone retaliate. I mean, nobody even mentions the idea of retaliation as even being possible. But, you know, just at least issue a condemnation, issue a strongly worded statement. None of them will do it. And that's truly remarkable. And I think before I heard about the evidence for it being an attempt to implicate the Egyptians, I used to think that this was just a demonstration of dominance by the Israeli military to the American military, that look, if you come near us, we are going to kill you. And to show you how serious we are, we're going to kill your, we're going to sink one of your boats, and we're going to show you how your political leadership is not going to do anything about it. Because remember, the U.S. military is under civilian leadership. Civilian leadership are a bunch of traitors, and we're going to show you now. I don't think that was exactly the intention. I think the intention was more likely now, I think that they wanted to implicate Egypt. Although, of course, we'll never know, because, you know, you can't have an investigation into those things. You save investigations for important things like, you know, Bill Clinton getting a blowjob. You don't care about these kind of things. And so we'll never really know, but I think the message has been very clearly delivered to everybody in the military brass that if you are in any way objectionable to the Israelis, there is nothing that your military, that your civilian leadership will do to support you. You are essentially run by a traitor regime that will side with a foreign country over you as a soldier.
Yeah, and obviously this is highly divisive in the United States, and frankly, something like I've tried to stay away from, but there is just something that's always nagged at me, particularly over the last few years, that I'm just getting back to like first principles thinking that has never really computed for me. And it was, I'm from Pennsylvania originally, and during the midterm elections, the last time around, Dr. Oz was running for the Senate in PA. And I remember getting fed a campaign ad for him where he gave this very impassioned speech because he was getting hounded for having dual citizenship between the US and Turkey. He went on this very impassioned speech saying, I have this passport, this Turkish passport, and this dual citizenship because my mother has dementia, and the only way I can take care of her medical bills and make sure that she's getting good care in Turkey is if I have this passport and citizenship and be able to navigate the healthcare system in Turkey. And at the end of the speech, he said, but I'm so passionate about the people of Pennsylvania, and I want to go to the Senate and make a difference for Pennsylvanians, and I will give up this passport to do that if I have to. And going back to the tip that Senator Massey has been on, and it just like first principles thinking, like the FAR Act, like foreign government shouldn't be able to influence individual American politicians. It's always like, in my view, it's like, all right, if we're going to let one do it, maybe we should let all do it. And if we're going to say we're not going to let anybody do it, maybe we shouldn't let anybody do it. And it's just first principles thinking, like, if we're going to make these rules, like, they should be followed. And some people will say that that's an attack on Israel or whatever, but I think just as an American thinking from first principles, it's like, what are the rules and are we actually following them?
Yeah, it's pretty startling. I mean, I think this was a major thing that also happened in the 1960s. And I think the 1960s were very pivotal in the U.S.-Israeli relationship. So you have the USS Liberty, but I think before that, John F. Kennedy was trying to get the precursor to AIPAC to register as a foreign agent, but then they shut it down and they opened up AIPAC, and so they managed to continue with that. And I think Lyndon Johnson was extremely favorable to Israel. So that period created a very strong bias in the regional intervention of the U.S. in that region. The U.S. wasn't all that active before then. But since 1967, since the war, they became a huge supporter of Israel, and they've been providing Israel with nonstop weapons and funding, essentially infinite, limitless amounts of money and funding unconditionally for all throughout that whole period, right after the USS Liberty. And I think it's absurd. I mean, if you think of the US as a country, then you wouldn't put up with any of this. I mean, there's no reason why this any country should get this kind of treatment. And of course, the really ridiculous thing is that people use the word ally to describe the US and Israel, and it is really, really funny. I mean, every time I hear an American say it, I really, really laugh. It's ridiculous, childish fantasy level stupidity. It's like watching a grown-up going around and talking seriously about what Santa Claus is going to do. Whenever I hear ally, that's exactly how ridiculous it is. The term ally has a meaning. Words mean things. And the word ally means a country, two governments that sign an agreement, a mutual defense agreement that contains specific terms. In case this thing happens, then we will give you this. And in case that thing happens, then you will give us that. If we're attacked by that country, you will fight with us. If we're attacked by that country, you may not fight with us. There's a whole bunch of agreements about terms that are laid out. The U.S. has no such agreement with Israel. So the idea that Israel is an ally is completely ridiculous. It makes no sense. And operationally, Israel is not an ally. Israel's never fired a single bullet in any American war. That's just never happened. And the U.S. has obviously provided infinite, endless financial and military support to Israel in all of Israel's wars. But the U.S. is... it doesn't exactly do these as part of any kind of official defense agreement. It's just like the U.S. military is an open buffet for the Israeli government to just come and take whatever they want. And of course, there's all kinds of spying cases that continuously get wrapped up. So Phil Giraldi, a former CIA agent, keeps writing about this. So just the number of cases of spying for the Israeli military that get uncovered in the U.S. military, and then they immediately get shut down politically because there's no political will to pursue any of these investigations. And of course, the other thing that's really ridiculous about the term ally is that the majority of the U.S.'s wars are not the U.S.'s wars. They don't matter for the U.S. at all. The only reason the U.S. is fighting all of those wars is Israel. The U.S. has no business whatsoever fighting a war in Iraq or in Syria or Yemen or in Libya or in any of those places. And I think it's very clear now, you look at what the neoconservatives were saying in the 1990s, this was the vision that they had and which 9/11 allowed them to implement, which is that they wanted to take out all of these countries that were hostile to Israel. And Israel couldn't take them out, so the U.S. did it. And that's really it. I think every single other justification for war for Israel is completely nonsensical. For wars in the for America's Middle East wars, it's completely nonsensical. There's no conceivable way you could make any justification for it. People say that this was a war for oil, and that's just ridiculous. You look at Switzerland and look at Kenya, look at Ecuador, look at New Zealand, look at Thailand. All of those countries are capable of securing oil. People all over the world can get oil, and the way they get it is they just pay somebody. And oil is vastly abundant in our planet. It's being produced all over the world. And it isn't as if, you know, you invade Iraq and then you get a lifetime supply of free oil for Americans. Whatever happens in Iraq, Americans are still going to have to pay for oil on the pump. And you may remember in 2003, the delusional Americans who thought, all right, we got war and now we're going to get cheap oil. And then the price of oil just kept shooting up because if you think war is going to give you cheaper stuff, you are an idiot and you deserve the poverty you get, because you're not just an idiot, you're also a criminal. But there's absolutely no reason for the U.S. to be involved in any of those wars. And all of this talk about geopolitics and regional dominance and projecting strength and bringing democracy, none of that stuff makes sense. No American needs to die in order for people in Iraq to have democracy. I mean, look at the state of American democracy. You watched the last election and you saw how that one worked out. Everybody's capable of running their own stupid rigged elections. You don't need to go kill them in order to do that. It's not that important. And all of the other justifications, they really make no sense. So it's not just that the Israel doesn't fight with the U.S.'s wars. U.S.'s wars are just Israel's wars.
Yeah. I mean, this is, as a millennial who has basically grown up with all the wars in the United States, the wars in the Middle East that the United States embarked on. I mean, that made me, especially in my younger ages and still today, like, very anti-war. Like, it never made sense to me. And I remember the war drumming that went on when I was like 10, 11, 12 years old in school when we were invading Iraq and Afghanistan. And it was just really odd. Even at a young age, I sort of was cognizant and recognized that in middle school, or not even middle school, it was grade school, I was in like fourth or fifth grade at the time. Like, they were really trying to instill this form of patriotism and warmongering in young kids. And it always seemed odd to me, and never sat well with me. And then obviously you move into the 2010s, you get the WikiLeaks, the Snowden leaks, and you find out that the government isn't really working on your behalf as an American citizen. And again, part of the reason why I brought you on, because I want to get to the core of these issues so that we can get to a point of peace, because I don't think these wars make sense. I think the way you described them is perfect. There was no reason for us to go over there. I don't think we should act as this moral, morally superior nation that is going to spread democracy. I just don't think that's how it works. I think it's a sign of like late stage empire decline. It's happened many times throughout history, what led to the fall of Rome and other empires in history's past is this expansion.
Although, if I may interrupt you here, let's just to give the Romans their credit. They really weren't anywhere near as stupid as this. When they went and invaded an area, they got tribute. They got the people who lived there to pay them money, and that money went back to Rome, and it allowed the emperors of Rome to have incredibly debaucherous parties. So at least it made a lot more sense than the idiotic American ideas of we're going to go there and spend trillions of dollars to try and get these people to have rigged elections like us. Like, there was no taxation imposed on Iraqi people to go give money to the U.S. government. If that was the case, American imperialism would make a lot more sense. We've got the biggest military in the world. We're going to go out there and try and get money for our government. But that was not the case. So you can't really compare it to the Romans. The Romans were, they got outstretched, but they were running a business, which, I believe eventually you're right. It does fall apart. I don't think it's the right way to build an empire, to keep trying to conquer people and to get money from them. You're better off saving your military and maintaining your strength and only taking in populations that want to rule over you. Still a lot less stupid than whatever America's doing these days.
Yeah. And we've got a lot of problems here that we need to fix. We've $35 trillion in debt almost. $217 trillion in unfunded liabilities. People are suffering. People are fat. People are getting dumber. And that's what's partly frustrating about this whole situation of American militaristic empire expansion, is that like it's not benefiting everyday Americans back here on U.S. soil. In fact, you make a very strong argument, I think you do in your books and your economic analysis, that you have to fund these wars somehow, and it means going into massive amounts of debt and expanding the monetary base, which really destroys people's purchasing power over time and their quality of life overall.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I know we had to reschedule this, so we've got a tighter rip than I hoped for, but I think maybe just switching to Bitcoin, like, could you see if Bitcoin adoption were to proliferate and the debt situation here in the United States and globally throughout the Western world were to become exacerbated, which seems like we're on that trajectory. Like, you see there's like a forcing function of just not being able to pay for this, and Bitcoin being adopted to really hone in this empire, this militaristic empire expansion.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, this is really the this is why we Bitcoin. Like, I like to focus publicly on the NGU aspect, number go up, cheer on the money aspect of Bitcoin, because that's what's really going to make the difference. Ultimately, the only people, not the only, but the main reason that people are going to get in is self-interest, and that's what Bitcoin has for it, and that's why Bitcoin doesn't need me or you, because people are self-interested. So for me, it's very important to emphasize that aspect if you're trying to attract people to Bitcoin. But I think the real value in Bitcoin is perhaps more important than Bitcoin rising, is killing the fiat monster, which I discuss in detail in the Fiat Standard. I mean, just freeing the world from this mass larceny that we've been subjected to for the last century, where all of our wealth is constantly being devalued and robbed and being given to governments that are being able to spend it with a lot less accountability than they would if they were just relying on taxes. And it's led to an enormous amount of suffering all over the world. So, I mean, if you asked me 10 years ago, and where would Bitcoin be 10 years from now? I mean, I'd have been careful probably and cautious, but I would have been optimistic that by now it would have grown enough to have made a serious difference in the world, and that it would have replaced the dollar as the main currency and then took away government's ability to finance themselves through inflation. Obviously, optimism is just great way of ensuring disappointment. So it hasn't worked out quite well, quite that well, at least not yet. But I mean, I don't know. I could be optimistic about it, but I don't know. I've also heard people talk about the U.S. fiscal crisis every year for the last 15 years, the U.S. dollar crisis every year since 2008. Really, people have been pounding the table saying it's all, this house of cards is coming down. It's all going to crash next week, next month, next quarter. Everything's going to crash. Everything is going to be the end. But it hasn't happened. And I think, I mean, yes, the situation now is worse. There's more debt accumulating. It is getting worse. It is getting, by many metrics, unsustainable. And you're tempted to start dancing on the graves, but I don't think we're there yet. And who knows? I mean, they just keep managing to pull more rabbits out of the hat and to keep the Ponzi going for longer. So they might be able to pull another one and keep it going. Having said all that, you know, to try and put in all my academic hat and to try and hedge my bets. But having said all that, I'd still say that, you know, we've reached a point now where the U.S. is spending more on interest than it is spending on military. which, you know, spends a lot on the military. There's a lot of murdering going on in the world financed by the US military. So imagine how much money is being spent on the interest on the national debt just to keep this debt Ponzi going. Americans are having to take on tons and tons and tons of taxes, to pay tons and tons of taxes. So it is reaching a point of unsustainability, I would say, by most metrics. I think Neil Ferguson has a metric where he says, this is the turning point. No empire is recovered from this. Once you start paying more for debt than you're paying for the military, it's curtains. That might be the case. But then again, if it comes this way, if it comes through government bankruptcies and defaults and hyperinflations, we're going to, who knows? I mean, we might just see a very, very ugly few years with all of these conflicts all over the world continuing to burn on more, causing more death, more destruction, and more horror all over the world.
Definitely the most tumultuous period in my life when you consider what's going on in Gaza, what's going on in Ukraine, the saber rattling around Thailand, or excuse me, Taiwan right now. And it almost seems like a desperate, like it seems like the incumbent power structure, the governments are like pushing us towards this because they know they need an excuse to print more money, and they want to see all this conflict around the world because it allows them to really run fear propaganda campaigns that ultimately enable them to push forward laws that give them more control in wartime. And that's what I hope bringing you on and trying to have more conversations like this is educate people like you're being manipulated emotionally via propaganda. And it's time to stop.
You know, I think COVID taught me this thing, which is for about 99.9% of people believe that the government shouldn't be spending money on everything, but it should be spending money on emergencies. So only the 0.1% is like the absolute most extreme anarchist nuts like me, or the absolute most extreme communist nuts who believe the government should own and run every single thing, including your toothbrush. Outside of that, everybody falls in that shades of gray category where they're having to choose when and where they think it's okay for the government to steal your stuff because they found a good story for it. And pretty much everybody in that 99.9% middle agrees that in the case of emergency, all bets are off. They get to do whatever they want. And so don't be surprised that you're constantly being inundated with emergencies. Every day is an emergency because every emergency allows them to get the consent of the majority of the people to printing money, taxation, totalitarian things, power grabs, all kinds of fun governmental activities become possible when you accept that there is a crisis.
Recognize that you're being manipulated. That's like if you're listening to this and you have an introspective moment where you realize you've been manipulated in the past. I think COVID is obviously the most glaring example because we just went through it. But I like to think that it woke some people up who originally got duped and then recognized that it was just a massive scam that ultimately led to the devaluation of their currency and the depreciation of their quality of life. I'm more hopeful these days because I do think some people have woken up, but there's definitely more people that need to recognize that they're being manipulated. Your fear instincts are targeted by these governments and these politicians, and you just need to recognize whenever you do get fearful because of something they say, it's like, oh, are they intentionally doing this to get a reaction out of me that would benefit them and their control over me in the long run?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, definitely COVID was a major one because it got so blatant at a point where it was very clear that there's a power trip at some point, that people in power had all of these tiny little despots, and it was like they charged them with just, hey, let's see how far you can push this.
Yeah. And they pushed it pretty far. They pushed it pretty far.
Yeah.
No, I think about it for my children too, particularly my oldest, who was born right before the lockdowns. it affected his life. He didn't see many people for the first 2 years of his life because we were on lockdowns, and led to a speech delay. And that's something that actually makes me angry, because he started his life off at a disadvantage because of these despots who wanted more control over society. It's actually pretty infuriating when you think about it and how it affects you at the individual level. And then the excess deaths that have materialized after the vaccine rollout, and it's touched my life. I've had people in my personal circles that have been affected by this, and not all of them recognize it, but I'm pretty confident that the effects of what happened in between 2020 and 2023 have led to a material degradation of quality of life, and in some cases, like literally leading to death, which should be infuriating.
Yeah, I mean, death rates have been up significantly since then, and fertility rates have been down significantly as well. And I don't think you can just dismiss these as flukes. And I think that, you know, the trend for birth rates at least was there before, but it amplified significantly after that. And it's I mean, for me, the whole thing, honestly, from the beginning, like I'm pretty proud of the fact that since January 2020, I called this thing a scam. I didn't know exactly what was the scam. I didn't know exactly what they were lying about, but I knew it was definitely a scam, because I was already aware of the World Health Organizations and the pharmaceutical mafia, and how they've tried to do these pandemics over and over and over again, and constantly ramping up their operations of getting people stoked up and peddling their pharmaceutical stuff. So I knew this was what was going on. I knew they were definitely exaggerating what was going on, but I wasn't quite sure how and why. But, and I wasn't obviously very, I didn't talk about this publicly much at that point, but for me, it was very clear from the beginning that, you know, this whole thing is going to be a very big marketing campaign for certain products that they're going to be pushing at the end. And that's really what it comes down to. Like, the entire thing is just a big giant shit test to then get you to take the magic potion. That was it. That's what it comes down to. And yes, there's been a lot of damage done to people. So many lives ruined. So many businesses destroyed. So many negative health damage done to people. Stuff you say about children is absolutely infuriating for me. I mean, my daughter was 4 at a time when she should be out there learning about the world and forced to be stuck at home. It's truly infuriating. But I really think the real thing ultimately was just, are you going to take that magic potion? That's what it comes down to. And it's just always the same thing with all these panics. There's always some very strong propaganda direction to push the panic in a certain way, to push the crisis messaging in a certain way, to market a solution. And that's what you saw in October 7, where all of this incredible atrocity propaganda got played up about all kinds of things. They really hype this up in order to justify the genocide that they've been angling for a very, very long time. So all of these stories about mass rapes and all of those stories about burning babies alive, all of that has been completely shown to be false, all of the most extreme ones. And it seems quite convincing that the vast majority, maybe not the vast majority, but a very large number of the civilians that were killed by friendly fire, because the Israelis didn't want their citizens to be taken as hostages. And this is a policy that the Israeli government has followed for a very long time, which is, we'd rather kill our own than have them taken away by enemies. And it's a way to discourage more and more of these kind of kidnappings. And so, you know, when you look at all of the hundreds of cars that were burned at the festival, there's no way that a bunch of guerrillas with a couple of guns can burn these. I mean, it's just, think about it logistically, how hard it is to burn hundreds of cars. But you can do it with helicopters very easily.
Safe. Thank you for coming on and talking about this. It's important to get the word out. And I think what you've been doing is putting your neck out there and being as vocal as you have been over the last year almost is important, because it certainly helped give me a perspective and understanding, more well-rounded understanding of the history of all this, and really leaning into, like, at the end of the day, it comes down to not only ultimately it's a human rights issue, but beyond that, like property rights and thinking from first principles. And it's important to get to, and it's conversations that people really don't like to have because it makes them feel a particular way. But I think as it stands today, considering all of the conflict that's going on around the world, these conversations are more important than ever, and people need to have the courage to have them. So I'm going to just give you massive props for going out there and speaking your mind and really getting these ideas out there, because I think it's imperative that we do that right now.
Thank you, sir. And the MVP on that one is Bitcoin. Obviously, it's what allows us to actually speak our mind. I don't have a fiat job to cancel me. So that's why I can... that's why, you know, I've been outspoken on all kinds of things when people would have usually just gone along with the herd. Climate change, COVID, Israel. The scams are endless. The nutrition, the diet heart hypothesis. so much. So many scams, so little time. But, you know, we're still going to be out there busting them as long as we can. So thanks for having me, man. I appreciate you giving me the platform.
No, appreciate you. Enjoy the rest of your Friday. Go have some fun with your family, and I'm sure we'll catch up soon.
Awesome. Take care, my man. Take care.
All right. Peace and love, freaks. Take care.